Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a departure from our usual conversations with World War II vets to meet a man for whom Memorial Day weekend is very difficult. He's a Purple Heart recipient who just underwent a groundbreaking operation to attach a new kind of prosthetic leg. And through his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, Justin Bond is on a mission to help his fellow veterans and slow the suicide epidemic among the veteran population. Justin's life was forever changed on April 9th, 2004. Maybe you've heard of Matt Maupin, the first American soldier listed as missing in action in Iraq. He was captured that day and later killed. Thomas Hamill was a civilian contractor captured and later escaped. He's written a book about the experience. But here's how that fateful day unfolded for Sergeant Justin Bond.
I was with my platoon, 3rd Platoon, and we came in off of a mission. We had been out for several days. I remember I just went and laid down on my bunk, put my weapon over my chest, didn't kick off the boots or nothing, just laid there. I heard Sestato was sick, and Sestato was one of our 6 saw gunners, and we had to have a saw gunner on each mission. And I heard, we're out of saw gunners. We got to have one. And I was just laying there, and in my head, I was like, ugh. I made a promise to my buddy, Sills, who was also one of the guys who was on the truck with me when we got hit. We made a promise in the early on that we're going to volunteer for any mission no matter what it takes, no matter what the situation is, you know? And so I sit up in my bed, and I was like, ugh. Been out so many days, and I could hear them talking, saying, bring all the ammo that you can load up on. This mission's dangerous. You're going to get hit. And it was Good Friday, April 9th, 2004, Good Friday. It was a one-year anniversary of the toppling of Saddam's army when the statue fell, when we took over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful, crisp morning. I said, I'll do it. My guys were like, you're not going. You're not going with them. You're with us, you know, and we're resting today. And I said, they need a saw gunner. We're going to go. So I loaded up, and I was with 2nd Platoon now. And when we left the gate, you just knew something. It was in the air. And I remember coming up on the MSR Tampa. It was a huge freeway, like in L.A. And we come up, and the morning was beautiful, though. All of a sudden, you could see smoke from around the country. As far as you could see, mushroom clouds started to go up. You could see tanks up over in the distance starting. And then we looked forward. I rolled forward in my turret. And I looked up, and all I could see in front of us was strips of grass and rocks and bricks going across the lanes of the freeway every 10, 15 yards, 20 yards. We knew there was IEDs planted in those, and the front gun truck had to pick and weave his way through to find, okay, that might be an IED in that bush or an IED in that one. So he picked and weaved his way through going real slow. We knew we couldn't turn these things around. You cannot turn these things around to save your life. I mean, you need like 30 acres, it seems like, to turn these trucks around.
So there's only one way to go.
One way. You're not coming back. We saw the smoke in front of us, and the convoy that left in front of us was Thomas Hamels. He was captured. When we came up on his trucks were fuelers, and they were pointed in all points of the compass. They were just scattered and all on fire, smoke plummeting from their vehicles. You could see them hunched over the steering wheel where they had been shot already. We knew, okay, these guys were only 20 minutes in front of us. Next thing you know, we heard a shot, and I looked at my driver, and we listened on the radio, and we heard fire from the right, but the radio went chaotic. The next thing you know, another bullet went, and it hit our truck, and I looked at my driver, and I'm like, that hit our truck. And looking, and we're out there, and we're picking, and we're scanning, and we're starting to fire back and suppress the fire. You know, if you're firing, like in the movies, when you fire, they got to duck down, you know. Mm-hmm. When you stop and reload, then they come up and fire. Only we find out later that there's 1,000 insurgents that have us surrounded, so they don't have to stop and reload.
And how many of you guys are there?
There's 21 of us at this point.
So it's 1,000 to 21.
Pretty fair odds.
I don't know about that.
So we just kept going and kept firing, and I looked at my driver, and he's like, Bond, you're hit, you're hit. And I didn't even know it. I knew one hit our truck. I knew I felt pressure, and I looked down, and both knees were pulsating blood. I took an AK-47 round right through the center of both knees. It ricocheted off the engine cover of the truck and went back into my left knee again, totally destroying it. All I could do is see people moving out there, but pretty well concealed, and trying to fire in those directions to keep them down. And then I could see people trying to pull, run up and get close enough to get up on the running boards and pull people out. Find out later, Thomas Hamill's convoy, they pulled him out and Matt Maupin out and another guy. And when I saw them, they were walking backwards. And they had them up by the buildings, which was 60, 70 yards away. And there was nothing we could do to help them. I had already been shot through both knees. And the bullets were just hitting us. We had trucks that over 20 bullet holes in the side. Well, my truck took a bunch in the, ate them in the fuel tank. We had trucks with no tires left, axles blown out, mortars coming through the beds, mortars barely missing our trucks. We got trucks where we're hooking up with chains, getting out during the firefight to hook up with chains to pull our own trucks out while still firing back. All of our big guns were down. All our 50s were down. Our Mark 19 grenade launchers were down. We were down to saws and M16s. We were down to my saw and an M16.
And you've been hit through both knees.
Yes, sir.
But you didn't feel it?
Didn't feel it at all.
But you look down and you see what's going on.
I see the blood. I see it. And I didn't have time to do tourniquets, to do field dress, to do anything. It was the only thing I could think of was, okay, I see my driver over here, and he ended up getting shot in the shoulder and the arm, and I see him twitch. And I'm like, okay, he just got shot. And I'm thinking, if he goes down, how am I going to get over there and drive this vehicle to keep it going, to keep the mission moving forward when both of my legs are shot out? And the only thing I can remember doing was moving my toes and feeling the blood sloshing in my boots filling up. And I'm like, okay, I'm still moving them, still doing that, but I'm trying just to stay calm. Don't get the adrenaline up, which is hard to do in a firefight.
Holy smokes. I mean, didn't you think you were going to die?
It never crossed my mind. What did cross my mind was being captured. And that was, I got my go bag beside me, grabbed my knife as I'm firing, threw my knife in my side pocket, and just prepared. Because I don't think we're making it out of here.
Well, how could you think you'd make it out of there? It's 1,021. You guys are already hit. I mean, all your guns are down, except for yours and some M16s.
Yes,
I mean, I'm sure people are listening to this saying, well, how is this guy here talking to us? What happened? How did you get out of that? How did you guys survive?
You know, the worst part about the whole thing, and the part I don't talk about a lot, is that I look over to the side and I see two guys pop up. I raise my saw up to them to do what we have to do, and before I could even pull the trigger, they were gone. Somebody else in the convoy took them out.
Because they're coming up to your vehicle trying to pull you guys out.
Yes, sir.
Which is what they had done to the convoy in front of you.
Yes, sir. These guys were about 15 yards out. Somebody else in my convoy takes them out. And I was like, okay. And then all of a sudden, a little kid pops up right beside where they were at. I think it was his son, one of the guy's son. And he looked at me. And we're doing anywhere from 0 to 3 miles an hour. But we're on a curve, a big curve right now, and we're elevated on a somewhat of a hill. This little boy looks at me, and time stood still. And he was, all I could picture, I mean, my son was barely over a year old, but all I could picture was my son, you know?
And how old was this kid?
He was probably 7. Mm. He would try and get that AK up, and he would get it up somewhat, and he would fire, and it would blow him back. And his eyes were just huge, just staring at me. I'd already got in trouble once for not shooting kids that were throwing rocks, because they would sit there with a pile of rocks, throw rocks, throw rocks, throw rocks, and then one of them would be a grenade. And I got told to take the kid out, and I didn't. And I got reprimanded for that. Here we are again with a kid, and I thought, I'm not built for this. I'll take out the enemy any day of the week. He's not the enemy. So I went to shoot, and I sprayed around him a little bit, and he kind of ditched and went down, and we're stopped. Next thing you know, he came up, and I said, God, I said, listen, I know I told you I was coming without you or with you, and I know you tried to stop me. I said, I don't have any right to call on you, but I am going to call to tell you that you promised that you'll never give us more than what we can handle. And although I said I'm doing this on my own, I said, I'm calling on you on that one, and I can't handle this. And my weapon turned into a machine, and my PTSD stops right there. The nightmares aren't bad with the kid anymore. The weapon shoots around the kid. The kid ditches his weapon and takes off into the bushes. And I know, God, he just took control. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no way. And there was no way I could have lived with myself like killing a kid.
Wow. But you're still right there. This is still ongoing. Your life's still in jeopardy. You're still, I mean, both of your legs are shot. You're bleeding all over the place. They're still 50-1 outnumbering you.
Yeah. Thomas Hamill was captured for 21 days, and then he escaped. And his book, Escape in Iraq, says 760 insurgents surrounded us, but they said that by the time our convoy got there, it was over 1,000 from satellite images. Yeah, we were way outnumbered, and out of nowhere, we somehow crawled out of the kill zone and got down the road a little bit. I can remember a Humvee, now he's Command Sergeant Major Chapman. At the time, he was Sergeant First Class Chapman. He pulls up, beside me in the Humvee at a few people. They jerk my door open and pull me out, and they grab my legs and they throw my legs out the window of the Humvee, and they sped off and got me to Abu Ghraib prison, which was just down the road. And I look back, but they got me out. They did a direct blood transfusion at Abu Ghraib prison from one of the prisoners and saved my life there.
Now, how many other guys in your vehicle were wounded?
Out of the convoy, out of the 21, I think it was 17 that got Purple Hearts.
Was anyone killed?
No, we all made it.
How unbelievable is that?
It's not. It's not.
It's not possible.
No.
All 21 survive, 17 Purple Hearts. You're one of them, and we're just getting started with the incredible part of your story here. So you're fading in and out of consciousness, but they get you out.
I'm out now.
You're completely out. So from this point for a while, you're only telling us what others have told you about what happened.
Right.
So what did they tell you?
I was in there, and they did a direct blood transfusion. One of the insurgents walked by the bed where we were at. They were transporting him and spit on one of our guys. And then I don't know if he spit on me or not, but the guy next to me, he spit on him. That guy tells me he just wanted to rip his head off, you know. Here we are getting life-saving treatment done, and the insurgents that we were just killing were trying to save their lives too, and they're spitting on us. So they stabilized me enough to get me to one of the hospitals, the big hospitals. They got me that far. They were losing me again. They stabilized me again, did a surgery there, and then they got me to another hospital, Balad, where they did another surgery and then medevaced me to Germany from there.
But at the prison. Is there an aid station that's already set up there?
It is. It's just for the prisoners, and we got our guys there running it.
So this just happened to be the closest place they could take you?
Yes, sir.
They take you there. The medical staff at the prison, which has been treating these Iraqi prisoners, they bring you in, and they say you need blood or you're going to die, as far as you understand.
Yes, sir.
They don't have a blood bank. The only way you're going to get blood is directly from somebody else's arm.
Either that, they were out of blood in that type. I don't really know. But yeah, they did direct transfusion. They hooked them straight up to me.
So they find an Iraqi who has your blood type. Did he volunteer to give it to you?
He was a prisoner. I don't think he has much choice.
So whether he said yes or they told him he had to, they hook him up to you, and your life is saved because of the blood of an Iraqi prisoner.
Yes, sir.
You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
When they told you that, did you believe it? Because you're out for all of this.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when they told you this?
It was a chaplain that told me this. Yeah. And I was just like, unbelievable still, you know. And I'm on morphine at this point and a bunch of things. But I just remember sitting back thinking about what we could have went through with that, you know.
You talk about the different operations. They get you out of there. They get you to Germany. And now I'm sure once you're conscious again, and you're starting to recover from some of these operations, you're probably starting to realize the scope of the injuries that you suffered.
Yeah, and they said, well, you're going to lose both legs. And they talked about amputating in Germany. Then they said, well, let's get him to Walter Reed. I remember I was in ICU in Germany, and I didn't even make the building at first. I was outside on the tarmac under tents because that's how many wounded came in. When I did make ICU inside, I was in the hallway, and that was ICU, and that's how full they were. Mm-hmm. And we get to Germany, and again, they triage and get me into a surgery right away. And I can just remember seeing people missing both arms and a leg. It wasn't about me. I was fine at that point. You know, I'm on morphine. I'm not feeling anything. I'm not hurting. I know I got shot through the knees. And I'm looking at these guys, and their limbs are completely blown off. And so to me, no injuries. I'm fine. You know, let's help these other guys out first.
At what point did it sink in?
Well, they kept saying we're going to amputate, and I kept fighting them on it. I'm like, nah, we're good. I'm good. You know, my legs are attached. It's just a bullet hole through it. You know, I'll do a knee replacement. And I fought them on it for 5 years. They kept saying, if you want to live this way, you're going to be in a lot of pain. And it was fine for the most part. And then finally one day I said, all right, it's time. The quality of life is way degraded. I'm looking at these guys on these prosthetics, and they're just going solid. And I thought that'd be much easier.
And how many operations have you had now?
I think we're at 37.
And counting, since he'll require a few more just to complete the installation of a revolutionary new prosthetic that attaches to a metal spike protruding from the bone. Time for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear about the mission Justin Bond is on now and how his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, seeks to prevent veteran suicides. And also his friendship with America's 43rd president and how Justin's portrait ended up in a new book. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.